uncertainty in fishery science and management. And that directly addresses this topic. They break that topic down into several things. What I'll be spending most of the time in my presentation on is understanding scientific uncertainty and its different sources, and then how best to communicate that and reduce it if possible. We have some particular changes since that report came out. Environmental change continues to be a challenge for science and for management, and managing that risk as well. And then I'll end with a couple slides on the risk policy, but I recognize that you'll be discussing that tomorrow as an agenda item. So Tom had sent this 2018 program review of the council, and there was a portion of that was on the impact of scientific information on the council's performance. And this review panel had several recommendations, and that is that the council would benefit from a better appreciation and understanding of uncertainty and how the scientific information available is limited to answer some of the council's questions. And their last recommendation was to have these short sessions on quantifying, interpreting, and communicating uncertainty. So I'll start with the National Aquarium Report, and there's a series of recommendations there. And this first one is just to clearly communicate what we're talking about with uncertainty, how it's treated and how it impacts the council. They break down uncertainty into two primary categories, scientific uncertainty and management uncertainty. Within science, we have data measurement error, model uncertainty, estimation error, and the ecosystem itself has a lot of uncertainty in what we assume as process error. Once the science is delivered to the council actions are not perfectly implemented. There's always some uncertainty in how the council actions will affect fishing effort, fishing mortality, and indirectly the fishery resources. Starting out with the first part of measurement error or uncertainty in the data, when it comes to monitoring the fisheries, we have a series of different programs, both at port and at sea, starting with the dealer reports. The dealer reports, you know, may be our most reliable information, where it's, you know, literally a census of all the seafood sold. So it's a census of commercial landings. However, it doesn't have any information on the fishing effort, where it was caught or how it was caught. Port sampling, that gives us the size and age composition that we need for most of our stock assessment models. But as you know, that's had some recent decreases in sampling intensity, and that's already affecting our stock assessments and generally increasing the uncertainty in our stock assessments because of the reduced sampling intensity. Recreational catch monitoring does a good job at estimating the species composition and the size composition of the catch, but expanding those samples up to the total recreational fishing effort is a challenge and hugely uncertain. So for some of our fisheries that have a large portion of recreational catch, the estimates of recreational catch are, there's a lot of uncertainty in that, particularly compared to commercial catch. Our investments of at-sea monitoring, we have vessel trip reports. Again, this is a census. All trips in these managed fisheries report on their fishing effort. That's self-reported data. The location requirements are imprecise, so we don't know exact locations and other information. We invest a lot in observers to sample the discards. There are some deployment and observer effects for observer data, and so that the observed trips may not represent the unobserved trips. That in itself adds uncertainty and bias. There's been recent developments in electronic monitoring. Those are still pilot programs that estimate discards. They have much higher resolution than things like logbooks, but with few exceptions, they're really not used in stock assessments yet. And then we have the vessel monitoring systems, much higher resolution of fishing location, But those are not currently used in stock assessments, though there are some steps forward to try to integrate those. For example, we have the catch accounting monitoring system, CAMS, that was peer reviewed last week. And the entire intention of CAMS is to integrate all of these streams of commercial monitoring data so that they can be combined and to give us more certain estimates of landings, age composition, size composition, ideally decreasing the uncertainty in our stock assessments by integrating these data. And you'll be hearing more about CAMS over the next few years. This is still a work in progress. Moving into the fishery independent data, we're lucky in this region to have quite a few fishery independent surveys. The primary role there is to determine stock trends, is the stock going up or down, and what the size and age composition of the population is. We're also fortunate to have multiple technologies, trawls, dredges, cameras, long lines, that we can survey different resources. However, particularly compared to fishery data, there are much fewer samples. For the entire stock area, we often have only a few hundred samples. And so that leads to relatively uncertain trends. So we have, for some stocks more than others, noisy indices. For some depleted stocks that are low stock levels, we have low precision. These surveys are usually pretty good at detecting big changes, but they're not as good at detecting small changes. So monitoring recovery of a low stock is often a challenge. We've had some recent changes in survey methods. Vessels, we're still trying to understand the catchability and efficiency of recent changes in gear. And another challenge has been missing or incomplete surveys, whether that's been due to COVID, whether that's been due to ship problems. And so that adds uncertainty as well. There are moves forward to integrate multiple surveys. Probably the best example we have is from our scallop surveys. That's the figure we have there. And that was from the scallop survey working group and how the different survey technologies are integrated. There have been several efforts through the research track to also integrate some of our state and federal surveys as well. So there's moves forward to try to reduce the uncertainty by improving the information content in these surveys. So moving from data to models, the data are hugely informative for these models, but we also need to make assumptions. Assumptions for these population dynamics models. Over the course of a stock assessment, there are dozens of decisions and assumptions that need to be made. Natural mortality is always one of the big ones. What's the rate that fish die from natural causes, particularly related to the rate they die from fishing? And that's always been an uncertainty, but in the context of climate change, there's a new challenge there that we may have changes in natural mortality that add uncertainty to our assessments. Fishery selectivity, how vulnerable are small fish to our fishery? How vulnerable are the oldest fish to our fishery? Hopefully those are informed by data. Often those are assumptions. Recruitment is another one. The addition of young fish to the population and how that's modeled can really add a lot of uncertainty. So our models not only estimate the stock size and the fishing mortality, they can also estimate uncertainty. We have measures of precision. They're usually based on how well the model fits the data. And so we can have things like confidence limits to our estimates. And that uncertainty can be used in management to estimate what the acceptable catch should be as a function of the overfishing limit. And so the acceptable catch can be a lower confidence limit of our overfishing limit, and that's using these estimates of precision from the model. However, those estimates of precision themselves may be underestimated, and I think we see this often from retrospective analyses, is that as we update assessments with new data, the changes to the estimates are greater than we anticipated just looking at the precision. So the inconsistency is greater than the imprecision, suggesting that there's more uncertainty here than we thought. And one of the recent trends is to evaluate uncertainty through simulation. So far, I've been really focusing on stock assessment models and estimating what the most recent stock size is, the most recent fishing mortality. That uncertainty really becomes amplified as we try to project forward. What is future recruitment going to be? Is the natural mortality going to continue to be high, change in the future, and the same with growth and selectivity? And so there are several ways that we can try to reduce this estimation uncertainty and the projection error. More and better information always helps. John Hare was talking about how can we increase port sampling. That would be a one way that we could reduce uncertainty. Stock assessment methods continue to evolve, and applying best practices in modeling can help reduce the uncertainty to try to address some of these assumptions. The more we can look to data rather than assumptions, getting field estimates of predation, consumption, field estimates of selectivity, maturity, so that we're not making assumptions in our model, that they're more informed by reliable data. I've touched on it a couple times, but the ecosystem change is one of the biggest challenges we have right now. There's always been uncertainty in stock assessment, but in the last few decades where our ecosystem's changing so much, some of those assumptions, which used to be fairly reliable, are now more suspect because we've seen changes in productivity. So the base rate of natural mortality, growth, or recruitment are a function of the ecosystem. We may need to reevaluate our expectations from a stock or from a fishery. And usually those are expressed as reference points. What our maximum sustainable yield is, our overfishing limit, our overfished threshold. We may need to reevaluate those. And that's often seen as moving the goalposts. But if things have changed and those changes are going to persist, we may need to remove uncertainty by improving our expectations. And finally, we can reduce process error by understanding the ecosystem better, by modeling the ecosystem more realistically, by making more realistic assumptions. We can reduce some of this process error in our stock assessments. And so the last form of uncertainty is management uncertainty and implementation error. We talked about how scientific uncertainty can be used to determine the acceptable catch as a function of the overfishing limit. For several of your plans, there's also an annual catch target that tries to address management uncertainty, and that could be catch that's outside the control of the council. That could be difficulty estimating in-season catch. There's a lot of reasons that the council decision may not be perfectly implemented, and that can be addressed through an annual catch target. So moving from that first recommendation of just understanding uncertainty, defining stakeholder roles and responsibilities is also important. The scientists and managers working collaboratively with the stakeholders so that we all understand our responsibilities on the scientific end to estimate and communicate the uncertainty from the stakeholder and the manager end to try to understand that uncertainty and to consider it in decisions. We tend to get real focused on the short-term decisions of what the catch should be next year, the next specification cycle. And everyone around the table is involved in that discussion. We can start to think longer term with addressing uncertainty beyond just the specification period into the objectives of the fishery management plan itself and how that's being implemented and what are the investments that are being done and how that plan can be implemented in the longer term to be more robust to uncertainty. And then even broader term than that is starting to think ecosystem, much longer term, whole of ecosystem, and try to address those uncertainties in a more ecosystem basis to fishery management. So reducing uncertainty of the next two recommendations is that strategic allocation investments in fishery-dependent independent data. There's been quite a bit of that in this region, and several of those are paying off to reduce uncertainty. Costs and benefits of additional research should be evaluated so that new methods might be able to improve stock assessment. A prioritization plan. This has been implemented nationally, but there's also the research track and NRCC that prioritize what resources to focus on. Management strategy evaluation is a tool that's been increasingly applied to try to address this, to identify issues, identify alternatives to address uncertainty. The recommendation four is more towards Washington, is to support the Magnuson-Stevens Act with greater investments in science. Particular attention needed to recreational fisheries and data-limited situations, and I think those two recommendations still hold. Also on reducing uncertainty, we have improving catch monitoring. Groundfish Amendment 23 dealt with that directly, but there have been several other initiatives. I think CAMS is another initiative there for catch accounting. And when the benefits outweigh the costs, accurate catch accounting really should be prioritized. That's probably the most important information that goes into our stock assessments. That's the probably the most important information for implementing management actions is monitoring the catch. Cooperative research has had great benefits, both for developing new technologies, understanding the ecosystem, understanding some of those uncertainties, and that can also be fairly cost effective. We've put a lot into new technologies, whether that's electronic monitoring or survey technologies, and they've been shown to improve the data that's available to us and indirectly reduce the uncertainty in our science. The frequency of stock assessments, that's been fairly well determined by the Northeast Regional Coordinating Committee. Most stocks are on a regular cycle of updates, and so they are, all of the stocks in this region are now frequently being assessed. And kind of the flip side of that is that the more regularly they're being updated, the less bandwidth there is to include new information. So as you know, we have two parallel tracks now, a research track that's really designed on innovation and providing new information, potentially from new technologies, and the management track, which has a more frequent update of those methods. Data limited stocks, I'd say, you know, technically there are no, or maybe Red Crab is a data limited stock in this region, but with decades of fishery independent surveys and monitoring that we have, when we look globally, our fisheries are not data poor or data limited, but we do have a lot of stock assessments that we're having difficulty modeling, where we usually fall back on just a data-driven management procedure. And so there's been some investments in this region to try to evaluate their performance of how well they perform from meeting the council's needs, despite the limitations and the additional uncertainty. Environmental change, as I said, is one of the major themes, and what we can do to try to address that is expand our oceanography research. I think, again, that's being done fairly well. A lot of that's expressed in the state of the ecosystem reports that you receive each year. Integrating new information into stock assessments. In the research track, there is a term of reference one that's exactly that, to identify ecosystem effects and to implement them into the data treatments and the modeling and the reference points so that the stock assessments are informed by ecosystem change, and prepare for environmental shifts through education, control rules, and reference points. We've had several evaluations of how our stock assessments and reference points can be more sensitive to environmental change. The Northeast Fishery Science Center has put a lot of investment into a new methodology, the Woods Hole Assessment Model. And one of the main features of that model is the incorporation of environmental effects into our stock assessments. And so WAM's now been applied to several stocks, and it's quite promising for this new frontier of considering the environment and environmental change in our stock assessments. And finally, risk-based management. As I said, you're going to be talking about this again tomorrow. This has been identified as a priority for this year. The recommendation from the National Aquarium was to adopt explicit risk policies. And this council, I think, has taken the lead on that in several ways. First off, you have an explicit risk policy, and you are incorporating risk into fisheries management actions and communicating them. And what I think is unique among councils is that applies not just to catch limits, that applies to other management actions that the council's taking. It's how to consider uncertainty, how to apply your risk tolerance to catch limits and other decisions. So there's a recommendation in the aquarium report to have formal procedures to communicate risk. And the plot on the left is the diagram that comes out of that, is that between the assessment author or the assessment working group and their review panel and the scientific and statistical committee and the council, that there should be several venues for communication and communicating uncertainty. On the right is more of our linear approach that we apply here, from the Northeast Regional Coordinating Committee down to the assessment leader group that gets reviewed, goes to the SSC, goes to the council, and that feeds back to the next iteration to the NRCC. There are some other interactions, and I think Lisa Kerr is going to be giving one today on the progress in the COD research track working group. So that's, again, one of these intermediate arrows. I think the main flow of communication of uncertainty is this more linear approach, but we should try to communicate as much as possible among the assessment team, the review panel, the SSC, and the council. Management strategy evaluation is something you're familiar with through several groundfish, herring, other MSCs that have been done in this region. And really, they're designed to test the performance of management procedures and how robust they are to uncertainty. And they're particularly well suited to evaluate robustness to environmental change, to data limitations, to estimation model. All of those different forms of uncertainty that we've defined can be represented in an MSC so that the management procedures that are being considered are at least simulation tested before they're implemented. So that if they don't work in simulation, if they don't work well in simulation, we shouldn't expect them to work well in reality. We should note that this is a fairly heavy lift, that this is a time-consuming process, an expensive process, but it can be worthwhile for confronting some of our major uncertainties. So really wrapping up here with the council's risk policy. 2014, the council set out objectives that recognizing that the information available is uncertain, the implementation is imperfect, and the policy is to weigh the risks of overfishing relative to the greatest expected overall net benefits to the nation. The purpose of the risk policy is to provide guidance to the council and council groups on risk, uncertainty in the specification setting process, communicate priorities and preferences on risk and uncertainty, and make the fishery management more transparent, understandable, predictable, while trying to achieve the objectives of each plan. There are several strategic approaches. Again, this is being reconsidered this year. Account for the probability of any undesirable outcome and the negative impact of the outcome. Those have been expressed most frequently in the undesirable outcome of overfishing or depleting stocks, and those are expressed as the acceptable biological catch being lower than the overfishing limit, or the annual catch target being lower than the annual catch limit. So harvest control rules can implement that. There have been several harvest control rules being considered for herring, groundfish, and others. considering the stability, not just the risk of overfishing, but trying to reduce wide swings in annual catch limits was also expressed as one of the objectives, and that all of the decisions should be analysis-based, that there are competing risks, and that ideally the risk decisions that the council makes are based on scientific analyses. So that's what I had prepared as this conversation starter. Again, just identifying the sources of uncertainty, how they can be communicated, reduced, or addressed in the council decision-making process, confronting environmental change, managing risk, and the upcoming council priority of revisiting the council's risk policy. Thank you, Chair.
Hey, thank you, Doctor. So in your opening remarks, you did say that, you know, this is not so much a question and answer with you, but a discussion amongst the council. But unfortunately, I'm thinking there's going to be some questions. So why don't we start with the council for questions and comments? Questions to the doctor and comments to each other. Anybody? Miss Eitri.
So I guess maybe I had a lot of coffee compared to others today. Quick on the draw. So in this presentation and thinking about the risk policy discussion we're going to have tomorrow, and also thinking about our ABC control rules, I see those three things as almost a circular building upon each other dynamic of how the council can more effectively, I hate to say this, create a framework for decision-making moving forward that identifies what we know is our uncertainty, what we acknowledge with evolution of EBFM and also changing in climate, what could be future uncertainties, and then developing that into the overarching risk policy for the council and then species-specific FMP ABC control rules. And I'm just curious, to me, that circular, which goes back to your slide where it shows the linear top-down approach we're currently using versus more of the feedback loop, circular feedback loop. And I'm wondering if you know of any examples in fisheries management or similar type environmental management where folks are developing these types of discussions in a more circular process, if that makes sense. And if you see what I'm saying about how I envision these three intersecting in decision making.
Yeah, thanks, Libby. I think really what it's adding interaction. So I think that the linear process that we have is necessary as far as tasking and delivery of the scientific information and using that information. I think what could be added are more interactions. And as I said, you know, the update on COD, that's kind of out of the linear cycle. It's going from the working group directly to the council as a heads up of what's coming. And those are the types of interactions. But things like having an SSC member chairing the peer review panel, there's another interaction. I think COD's probably a great example because we've had a lot of workshops leading up to this. We knew that there were potentially big changes coming. And the people who are leading this process recognize that additional interactions would help. And I think that's a good example of it, but that could be more regular as well, is that there can be more of these interactions among that linear, the main flow of information and decisions are coming from that linear plot, but there's more interactions. I'm familiar with more examples in this region than others, and I think the COD one is probably the best one that I can come up with.
Ms. Denise?
One of the advantages of a linear process, of course, is that sometimes we're under pretty tight time frames to get things done. And interactions take a lot of time if you go back and forth, particularly if you have to have some kind of sort of formal meeting set up. So I think that, you know, one of the ways you can get this, I don't like to call it circular thinking because that sounds bad, but one way you can get the interactions going And this, I think, is a concept that the council talks about, is you establish your policies in a clear-cut way up front through a lot of these interactions with people. So everybody knows that when the linear process starts, this is how it's going to work. And there's not a lot of questions about how it's going to work. Now, that doesn't mean it's cast in concrete, because we're going to learn new stuff all the time that we're going to have to take into account. I think that is, at least in theory, the concept that the agency puts forward in National Standard 1 with ABC control rules, which, as I'll talk about tomorrow, is a very narrow, perhaps, application of risk policies. But I guess my point is, I think there's a place for both of those. You know, if you think of the timing we have from the management track to when we have to set specifications for monkfish, for example, there's not a lot of time to have a lot of formal interaction between the groups that are working on that stuff if you want to get it done on time, which the fishery wants to happen. So ideally, when you create your control rules and develop your risk policy, that's a real good place where you have more time to have those interactions and figure out how to deal with them. Or one option, anyway, put that way.
Ms. Etrie?
Thanks, both Steve and Tom. And I agree. I wasn't trying to infer that top down was not the correct way. I was trying to actually start the thought process and discussion amongst the council, because we are going to be talking about the risk policy within groundfish. We have a priority as it relates to the ABC control role and ranking that as our top priority. And so uncertainty and our understanding of uncertainty and our understanding of what we don't understand about uncertainty plays heavily into both of those discussions, into also, to me, using the opportunity such as the risk policy, the council's risk policy, is to not just clearly develop what our risk policy is, but to have a better understanding about what that serves as a tool for the various bodies we work with moving forward and how they view the risk policy. So I would just say, for tomorrow's discussion and future discussion, this intersect between risk policy, our understanding of uncertainty or lack thereof, and our ABC control rules present a really unique process for the council to dig deep and develop processes and procedures that help guide our decision-making process in the future, that not only inform us, but inform stakeholders of kind of the bounds of those decisions and what we're trying to accomplish. That I think could actually expedite some of our discussions and some of the complications we've seen with results coming out that we don't like, but it's kind of within the process. So throwing that out there for food for thought, both in this discussion and tomorrow's discussion and future discussions.
Mr. Arestat, and then Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Catering, great presentation. Certainly gave us a lot of stuff to think about. You made the point that improved catch accounting could be one of the most important ways to reduce uncertainty. And I think a lot of us would agree with that. And then there's the sort of the general statement that we could, I'm sure, all rally around. It says, when the benefits outweigh the costs, accurate catch accounting should be prioritized. So I guess what I'm wondering is, what does that really mean? How do you do a cost benefit analysis? I'm sure we could approach it a lot of different ways. I'm not looking for answers right now, but I think it's a really important point that all of us around this table probably need to give some serious thought to. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. I have Mr. Tracy, then Mr. Smith. Alan.
All right, thank you. Really great presentation. I hope we can get more of this type of information exchange. It's really helpful. A lot of questions, but I guess the one I'm kind of circling around is, one of the takeaways from your presentation for me was, you know, the simplified vision of you have data and you have models. And that's really what this process comes down to. And as council members who are not trained in the science, you know, and I know that's acknowledged by the scientists, but one of the things that I find very challenging, maybe others do too, is determining when we get a recommendation that meets the best science standard. The next layer of analysis of that of that, those conclusions. That's very challenging. For instance, we have monkfish, which, you know, we spent quite a bit of time in the last meeting. Maybe we'll spend more time today. That had data and that had a model. Now we happen to spend a lot of time coring into that. So we seem to be getting to the bottom of it, but there's a lot of other instances. I guess the short question is there a way for council members, knowing that they rotate and there's always new people that need to digest, to be able to get a good sense of not just did it meet a baseline standard, but how accurate is it? Because they're so different with how they come loaded. Thanks.
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that, but I'm not the only one to provide. I'm sure there are other replies at the table. But from my perspective, you know, best science isn't just a number. In fact, I think we need to demand more of that from our scientific system, is that in addition to our best estimate of whatever it is, whether it's a stock size or it's an economic impact, that we try to evaluate the uncertainty in that number as well. And that we ideally measure the uncertainty in that estimate and we communicate the uncertainty in that estimate. Now, for things like stock assessment, that's pretty well baked in at this point, is that we do provide that as a term of reference from our stock assessments, because your scientific and statistical committee needs both the number and its estimate of uncertainty to make their recommendation on acceptable catch. And so I think your question is really expressed in one of the recommendations here, is more clearly evaluating and communicating uncertainty to the decision makers so that you don't just get the best estimate, our best science, that you have an honest assessment of uncertainty in that estimate so you can make decisions in that context.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that's exactly what I'm asking. And I agree, you know, being able for us to cue in much easier and closer on that uncertainty risk is really helpful. So saying the same thing, appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Mr. Smith and Mr. Salerno, and then anybody else, please.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Cameron. I have two questions, if that's all right. Steve, thanks for the presentation. Super helpful. My first question had to do with, I think it was recommendation 8, was addressing the frequency of stock assessments. And you noted that here in New England, we have increased the frequency of our stock assessments. And I'm trying to resolve that with our risk policy, which one of the goals of that is to try to avoid swings, you know, big swings in the catch advice. And I'm just curious if you have, you're smiling, so maybe you've thought about it. How do we resolve that desire to have more frequent stock assessments with a desire to not have big swings in catch advice?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, in principle, the more frequent our stock assessments are, the more we're reducing uncertainty. The longer you let things go, the more likely there's going to be a big change in perception, is that you're not, the more frequent you're assessing, the more robust your system is to uncertainties, that at least you're monitoring change. Even if you don't entirely understand the change, you can be responsive to that change the more frequently you're updating assessments. But your point is a valid one, is that the more frequently you update assessments, the more frequent changes there can be as well. And I think, you know, if those more frequent changes are in the right direction, then that's an improvement. If they are just bouncing around because of uncertain data, poorly performing models, then they may not be improving the system. So, like I said, in principle, more frequent assessments should help. But that assumes that we have reliable data and reliable assessments.
Mr. Neese, hang on, Jeff. Mr. Neese, would you like to add on to that?
So I actually think I'm gonna wander a little bit away from your question, Jeff, but I think it's on point. I actually think that there's a role in there for the council's decision making and risk policy to help with that issue. And I'm gonna use scallops as an example. We have a very successful scallop fishery, and you know, very high value species. If you were to look at some of our, I forget what they use, annual landings, APL or whatever it is, those numbers have changed. We've authorized changes from like 30% from year to year, and nobody bats an eye, right? Now, admittedly, it's a high value fishery. Nobody bats an eye because the changes are never large enough to trigger us into being overfished so that we have to develop a rebuilding plan. And if you look at in the weeds of the scallop fishery, we are generally speaking managing the fishery at a very conservative F level. And there might be a lesson there, right? That, you know, you avoid some of those swings if you can get the stack, get a stock up into a condition where it's not overfished, you don't have a rebuilding plan, where there are fluctuations from year to year, but they're manageable, if you will. So, you know, I don't think it's just a question of how frequent assessments are. I think it's a question of what you do with them when you get them as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Tom. And I think part of it is also the degree of confidence that the stakeholders have in the assessment process and that the assessment is reflecting what's being seen on the water. And that if those are consistent, I think it's easier to take the results of the assessment if they're consistent with what people are seeing. My second question, Steve, you kind of teed this one up for me, and it was talking about the reliability of the data that's going into the assessments. And on the slide on the uncertainty in fishery data, you pointed out both electronic monitoring information and vessel monitoring system information as, you know, higher resolution information that we have available to us. It's not being used in the assessments right now, and I'm curious about why that is. My understanding, at least on the EM data, is it's high resolution discard information. My understanding is that that information is used when we're looking at total removals in the fishery. So it is used in the assessment to some degree, but I want to check my understanding on that. But maybe it's some of the length information that is not being used in the assessment. So I'm curious if we have high resolution discard information from EM, if you have a perspective on why it is that we aren't using them in their assessments or what we could do in order to bring that information into the assessments to help their performance.
Yeah, I think I can speak to this as the chair of that fishery data for stock assessment working group and the chair of the place working group, where we confronted exactly the question you're talking about. And because the EM fleets are such a small portion of catch from some stocks, they have not been used in assessments. So even though EM discards are being used for catch accounting, for management, for in-season quota monitoring, they haven't been used for stock assessment. In fact, most of our, almost all of our discards are still observer-based. And so EM trips still have some observer coverage. And so we're using the observer samples to estimate discards for the entire fleet, including the EM trips. Now, hopefully that will change. And CAMS, this catch account and monitoring system, is attempting to integrate all of the data streams, including EM, into this. And so far, that decision to use observer-based discards has been largely based on the amount of discards in the EM fleet. And they've so far, you know, between the max retention and the audit program, they haven't accounted for a lot of discards of place or cod. The assessments where we've considered using it. Now, I should say for max retention, all of those landings categories are included. Since those come to port, they're part of the dealer weigh-out, even the sublegal or unmarketable. Those did go into the place assessment. But again, a small portion of the catch. The EM at-sea discards did not. But there's a recommendation there that as that program grows, we actually develop methodology in the place assessment so that during the management, we don't need to wait until the next research track for place. When the magnitude of EM discards of place gets considerable within the management track, we can switch to using EM. So I hope I explained that. So The short answer is no, we're still not using EM discards in assessments.
Okay, interesting. So, but did I understand you to say that discard data from an EM trip is considered useful at assessment if there's a NEFOP observer on there catching it, but that if that there's a NEFOP observer measuring the fish, but the same trip that has a camera system with following the protocol, that information isn't useful for the assessment?
I didn't say they weren't useful. I said the decision was to use the observer data rather than the EM data. And I think we realized that actually, if I have a little time, when it came to discard mortality, we're able to use the time on deck from EM to help us inform our discard mortality. And so that was in working with Mel Sanderson and Kate and others on placed discards from EM. We had a partnership going there. And when it came to this big question of discard mortality and time on deck, we were able to go back to the EM and use it. So I know that it's really good data and it's really informative data. It's just not a large enough portion of the fleet yet. And there isn't a data protocol to get it in the stream. CAM should address that. CAM should give us a way to start taking advantage of that valuable data.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Dr. Hare.